From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. We're on the eve of Super Tuesday, the biggest day so far in the 2020 Democratic race. 14 states and one territory will hold primaries or caucuses, and candidates are competing for about a third of overall delegates at stake. The field is changing rapidly. Vice President Joe Biden gained his first victory in South Carolina Saturday. Billionaire Tom Steyer and former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg both quit the race over the weekend. And former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg will finally be on the ballot after two debate appearances and hundreds of millions of dollars in advertising. For more on what's at stake tomorrow, we're joined by NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. And Domenico, let's start with South Carolina. As we know, Biden won big there. He had dismal showings in Iowa and New Hampshire and Nevada. Is this a signal that Biden's campaign has rebounded?
Look, Joe Biden won by a lot in South Carolina, a lot more than people expected him to be able to do. He did tremendously well with African-American voters who make up the majority of the voters in South Carolina. And for all of those Democrats who are uncomfortable with Bernie Sanders as the potential nominee, a lot of them had been wondering who should they support. And I would argue that as much as what mattered as Joe Biden's finish Saturday night, it was his speech afterward. That was the Joe Biden that a lot of Democrats, moderate Democrats, were hoping to see. They had been wavering because his public appearances haven't been very strong. And you're starting to see a coalescing around Biden. At least his campaign hopes so. The biggest threat to him, Super Tuesday, of course, is Mike Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, who has spent almost $250 million just on the Super Tuesday states and ads.
I want to ask you more, though, about those states to the south, because history has shown us that they often follow the lead of South Carolina. Do you think that Biden is expected to pick up wins there now that he's proven himself in South Carolina?
I mean, look, definitely there are a lot of places that I think that have, you know, a significant population of African Americans in the Democratic primary who could move now more en masse toward Joe Biden. I'm thinking of places like North Carolina, Alabama, Arkansas. They don't have as many delegates, though, as, say, a California. And Biden has only spent $600,000 on campaign ads in these Super Tuesday states in just about half a dozen. And when you add up all the delegates in those states, they only come out to about 40%+ of the delegates that are available on Super Tuesday.
Let's get to those states with those high number of delegates like California, as you said. Bernie Sanders is still the front runner. He has the most delegates and he's polling ahead in several Super Tuesday states, including California and Texas. How far could wins in either of those states take him to the nomination?
You know, there's a key number to watch, and that's 15%. In every single state, in order for anyone to get any delegates, they need to get above a 15% threshold. Delegates are allocated by statewide total and by congressional district. So there are 53 congressional districts in California, and for you to get any delegates in those congressional districts, you have to get above 15% in each of them. So when you look at the polling right now, Bernie Sanders is the only one who's clearly above the threshold in California. Elizabeth Warren has been above 15%, but the other candidates have not at all gotten above 15%. And if you have a situation in which Bernie Sanders happens to be the only person who gets above 15%, he would wind up with all of the state's 415 delegates. And if something like that were to happen, no one is going to catch Bernie Sanders in the pledged delegate lead. So if you're Joe Biden, you've got to hope that you're getting a wave of momentum to push you above that 15% threshold and hope that Elizabeth Warren takes some of those delegates away from Bernie Sanders, especially with how he ran up the score with Latinos in Nevada. They're expected to be about 30% of the electorate in California. And if he runs up the score with them again, he could wind up with a net of 100 delegates or so, and no one's going to catch him.
Okay, so thinking about all of the things that you just said and looking at the top contenders, they really are Sanders and Biden. And it's really uncertain about the alternatives between them. You brought up Warren, but what does the contrast between Sanders and Biden tell you about divides within the Democratic Party itself?
You know, these lanes we talk about are not as clear cut as we think they are, but Bernie Sanders is as left and progressive as they come in the Democratic primary. And Joe Biden is as moderate and establishment as they come. And right now it is shaping up to be a Sanders versus Biden race, depending again on how someone like Mike Bloomberg does and how many delegates he might siphon away from Joe Biden on Super Tuesday.
That's NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we've been hearing today from surrogates for the leading Democratic campaigns, and we're joined now by Congressman Ro Khanna of California, who is supporting Bernie Sanders for president. He's on Skype. Congressman, welcome back.
Great to be on the program.
Well, and before we get to the political news, I just want to ask you about the other big news, which is the coronavirus. The first case of community spread took place near your district in Northern California. Do you think your state and the country are prepared right now to handle a full-blown outbreak?
We're not. We need to do more. The first thing we need to do is to get an inexpensive diagnostic test out there to healthcare providers everywhere in the country. I mean, as you know, right now, only about 500 people have been tested. It has to go through the CDC, and we don't have the means to get people tested. The second thing we need to do is make sure we're investing in vaccines or antivirals so that we have the best possible treatment. And finally, I think we need to have some policy on paid sick leave in this country. I mean, we want people to be paid and stay at home if they're sick and not coming to work where these things spread. So we have a lot of work still to do.
But that's not something that could be done right away anyway, right? The paid sick leave part of it.
The paid sick leave can't be done right away. What I would say we should do right away is pass $15 billion, give it to the CDC, give it to NIH, and have them focus on getting a cheap, inexpensive diagnostic. That, I think, can be done, making sure that they have the proper protection for healthcare workers who may deal with the coronavirus, and putting as much funding as they deem, as the scientists and doctors tell us, for potential cures, or at least potential ways to mitigate the impacts of the disease.
Turning to politics in the presidential race, what do you think Pete Buttigieg getting out of the race means for your candidate, Senator Sanders?
Well, first of all, let me just congratulate Pete Buttigieg. He was a trailblazer. He did something pretty remarkable as a 38-year-old gay American to make it this far. And I think he has left us a better country because of his race. If you look at the polling in Morning Consult, his voters, some of them are for Biden, some of them are for Warren, some of them are for Bernie. So I think it's going to be for each candidate to make the case to them. They won't go to one candidate automatically.
What do you think success will look like for Bernie Sanders tomorrow?
Having the delegate lead, obviously, I'd like the lead to be as big as possible. I'm very confident he will emerge with the delegate lead. It's important to realize that California's count could take a couple of weeks because we count absentee ballots. So I imagine that whatever the count tomorrow isn't going to be even fully indicative of what his lead is. But as long as he's in the lead, I will be happy.
But will he have to win in more places than just California tomorrow?
Of course he will. And I think he will. I think he's going to do very well in Texas. He's going to do very well in Virginia. There are a number of states where he's going to do very well. But, you know, I'm a little biased because I represent Silicon Valley in California, and I hope my home state gives him the biggest margin.
Let me ask you one more thing, which is obviously Senator Sanders' signature proposal is Medicare for all. Do you think, as a member of Congress, and you see how difficult it is to get things passed in Washington, do you really think that enough members of Congress, members of the Senate, would vote to take away the private health insurance that so many Americans have in order to replace it with Medicare for all?
Well, that's actually not what the bill does. The bill extends Medicare to everyone. It allows for supplemental private insurance. So it's a myth that the bill takes away anything. What it's doing is offering everyone health care, Medicare, improved Medicare, which covers long-term care, vision, dental. And I do think there are already a majority of the House Democrats who would vote for it. I mean, I think if you were sitting in 1932 and you asked people, did you believe that FDR would get the Social Security Act in 1935? Very few people would have been able to predict that. So my view is if Bernie Sanders actually becomes president, the political forces that would unleash would build the majority to get that done. In a negative sense, we've seen that with Donald Trump. I mean, his election transformed the Republican Party into his image. And so I think if Bernie Sanders wins, a lot of his policies will be things that members of Congress will support and their constituents will expect them to support.
Just to be clear, though, the plan that Senator Sanders offers would take people off their current health care plan.
What the plan would do is it would provide Medicare for everyone. Currently under Medicare, if you're over 65, you can't get duplicative private insurance. That's the current law. So if you're 67 and you're on Medicare, you can get private insurance, but it has to be supplemental. And what Senator Sanders does is extend that to everyone. So if you're 55, you have to enroll in Medicare. You get Medicare. If you don't like what you get from the federal government without premiums, without copays, without deductibles, you're free to still get private insurance under his plan.
That is Congressman Ro Khanna of California, who is supporting Bernie Sanders for president. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Indeed. Are you hiring? With Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on your short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Get started today at Indeed.com/here now.
Global markets bounced back somewhat today after Wall Street saw its worst week since the 2008 financial crisis amid concerns about the new coronavirus. Joining us now is Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary under President Clinton, who also served as Director of the National Economic Council under President Obama. Larry Summers, welcome back.
Glad to be with you, Jeremy. A lot going on.
A lot going on. And do you think that the worst is over economically after that huge drop in the markets last week?
No. I don't know what's going to happen next to the market, but in terms of disruption to the economy, I think we're only beginning. I've heard it said that the shipments into the port of Los Angeles are going to go down by 25% this month. And that, of course, means inputs to American factories, inputs to American stores are going to go down after that. So in terms of what's going to happen to the real economy, I'd be surprised if we were past the second inning. We have to reckon that there's a real possibility that this is going to be in the broad range of where the flu was after World War I. And if that's the case, we are looking at an event that will possibly dwarf the events that have taken place in wars.
Do you think that it is unavoidable at this point that the U.S. goes into a recession as a result of coronavirus?
No, I think there's a far greater chance of recession within a year than I would have judged 6 weeks ago. But there's so much uncertainty in this situation that nothing is inevitable. But I'd be very surprised if we didn't see a significant slowing. And I think the odds are even or better that we'll go into a recession in the next year. And I think it will be a very difficult recession to combat. To start with, starting with interest rates near zero, any recession would have been hard to combat. And a recession that's induced by the fact that people are afraid to gather together in crowds is going to be a recession that's much more difficult to combat with lower interest rates than normal recessions.
Well, on Friday, the Fed Chair Jerome Powell said in a statement, quote, "The fundamentals of the U.S. economy remain strong," but he said coronavirus does pose evolving risks to economic activity. And he said the Fed will use its tools and act as appropriate to support the economy. Today, President Trump tweeted that Powell and the Fed are slow to act. He said Germany and others are pumping money into their economies. Other central banks are much more aggressive. The U.S. should have the lowest rate. What do you make of all that? How do you think the Fed should respond?
The president's comments, as has often been the case before, are confused. Other countries have lower interest rates because they believe in negative interest rates, which many in the United States think would be counterproductive. They have lower interest rates because they're already much closer to a recession. When the reason output is going down is that people aren't leaving their houses because of quarantines. It's not at all clear that monetary policy is going to do anything that is terribly effective. We only have so much room for monetary stimulus left, and we're going to need to dole it out rather than shoot it all off at the very beginning. So I think the president, by making monetary policy look political, is reducing whatever efficacy psychologically it might otherwise have. He would be much better off restoring the funding cuts he made for pandemic preparedness. He would be much better off reversing the decision he made earlier to not regard global health as an essential component of our national security. And at a time when supply chains are being ruptured all over the place, we have all the interferences we need with international trade. And what he should be doing is scaling back those interferences, not beating the drum about more tariffs.
What about fiscal stimulus? Do you think that it's time for Washington to start thinking about a stimulus package?
We certainly should be thinking about fiscal stimulus right now, and injecting money directly into the economy through government in order to help people get better and to avoid contracting this disease is a much better strategy anyway than reducing interest rates below 1%.
Larry Summers, before we let you go, you mentioned at the top that there's a lot going on right now. Tomorrow is Super Tuesday. You're in Massachusetts, which votes tomorrow. Who are you going to vote for?
Oh, I keep that to myself, but I'll give you some hints by saying that I don't think this is the moment for radical economic experimentation that focuses on tearing down the most fortunate people in the society rather than inducing everybody to work together and contribute to do what's most important, which is lifting the middle class up. Senator Sanders' plan would move the United States from being one of the most market-oriented countries among the rich industrialized countries to being virtually the most government-run. And in that sense, it does have important aspects of a move to, as his political party refers to itself, socialist policies.
Okay, well, I think I can guess from that who you're not going to be voting for. Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary, former Director of the National Economic Council under President Obama. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, no one likes getting a speeding ticket. It can cost you a couple $100 and raise your insurance. The consequences can be much more severe for those who can't afford to pay. But a court in Fort Worth, Texas, is offering people a second chance. Christopher Connolly of KERA reports.
These days, when Ashley Bryant drives around in her black Nissan, she does it without the anxiety that she carried for 6 years whenever she got behind the wheel.
Every time, you know, I do this, I pray before I get in the car. I feel like, God, please cover me while no police won't get me today.
Bryant used to have a bit of a lead foot, she says, and by 2012, she'd racked up a half dozen tickets. She's a certified nursing assistant and simply couldn't afford to pay for them. When she didn't, she ended up with an arrest warrant from the Fort Worth Municipal Court. Her license was suspended, and that made every drive to get groceries, to pick up her kids, stressful.
It's scary. You know, you gotta look behind you, make sure the police not going to turn around and get you, because you know you're going to go to jail because you have a warrant, you know.
But in 2018, Bryant heard about a new thing the city of Fort Worth was doing, a warrant forgiveness program. Basically, it's a push to get people to work with the court to resolve outstanding citations.
I wasn't going down there because I'm going to go to jail because I didn't have no money. But then when I found out it was safe through the Warrants Forgiveness Program, you know, I took that chance and went.
At the beginning of February, Fort Worth Municipal Court had 280,000 outstanding warrants, mostly for unpaid parking tickets and some code violations and other low-level Class C misdemeanors like shoplifting. Municipal Court Chief Judge Danny Rogers says a lot of people kind of ignore tickets when they don't have the money to pay them. Others get confused.
They don't quite understand what to do. If you look at a ticket now, it's 3 pages long. People don't read that, so they don't understand. So if we can get them to come to us, talk to us, we can help them get in a situation that they can handle it.
For years, the municipal court would participate in statewide roundups, tracking down people with outstanding warrants. But a few years ago, the court shifted strategy, launching Court in the Community events to help people resolve old tickets. Some fines get dropped. There's also payment plans or community service. 40,000 cases have been resolved that way.
Just come see us. We have no interest in putting someone in jail because they don't take care of their tickets. We really want people to come in and resolve their tickets.
Not taking care of tickets can get expensive fast. Depending on the city, there are fees to get on payment plans, collection fees, fees for having a warrant issued in the first place. If you don't come to court, you can get charged with failure to appear. If your driver's license is suspended, you can get tickets for driving without a license. Your car insurance rates go up. And of course, you could actually get arrested.
If at any point you have the money to pay what you owe and you just go to the court and give them the money, all of this kind of goes away.
Mary Mergler is with the social justice group Texas Appleseed.
So clearly the people who have these warrants and license suspensions are struggling to pay because money makes these problems go away, but they just don't have the money.
Mergler praises Fort Worth Municipal Court for trying to work with people like Ashley Bryant. She's still paying off the original tickets, $25 a month. She's got her license back and has car insurance she can afford, and now...
I feel like I can drive in peace, you know, since I didn't take care of my business as, you know, taking care of my warrants.
Bryant knows a lot of people with warrants from unpaid tickets, and she hopes they can face their fears, head into court, and work out a plan to pay them off. For Here and Now, I'm Christopher Connolly.
You might know Nick Kroll from his very raunchy animated show on Netflix, Big Mouth.
Are you the puberty fairy?
The puberty fairy? I'm the hormone monster. I'm not a fairy.
Well, now he's starring as a romantic lead in a movie set at the Olympics. Actor and comedian Nick Kroll, next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
The International Olympic Committee remains committed to holding the Games in Tokyo this summer, even though other sporting events are being canceled over concerns about the coronavirus. The Olympics are scheduled to open July 24th, and over the weekend in Atlanta, three men and three women secured spots on the U.S. team in the marathon trial races. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock was there.
Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottom set the stage for the marathon trials when she talked about the three things people always mention when they meet her.
One is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The second is Gone with the Wind. And the third are the Olympics.
The civil rights leader was born in Atlanta. The Civil War novel by Margaret Mitchell that became the famous film is partly set in this southern city. And Atlanta hosted the Olympics in 1996. Those games were disrupted by a bombing that killed one person and injured more than 100 others, but the competition continued, and that spirit was reflected in the marathon trials. The Olympic cauldron, lit by Muhammad Ali to open the 1996 games, was relit on Saturday and burned during the 26.2-mile race. Oregon's Galen Rupp, Jake Riley from Colorado, and Abdi Abdurrahman, who lives in Arizona, captured the first three places in the men's race on Saturday. Rupp also won the 2016 marathon trials and snagged a bronze medal in the Olympic marathon in Rio that summer. Abdurrahman made his fifth Olympic team on Saturday, Jake Riley his first.
I mean, you're seeing somebody live their happiest moment of their entire life, so that's pretty special right now.
Elafine Tuliamuk won the women's race, Molly Seidel finished second, and Sally Kipyego was third. Seidel was an NCAA champion at Notre Dame, but she's also battled depression and an eating disorder. So what she did on Saturday marked a comeback. Tuli Amuk and Kip Yego were both born in Kenya, but are now U.S. citizens. Kip Yego has already represented Kenya in the Olympics. Now she's going as an American.
I have lived here for 15 years. I have felt like this is my home. America has given me a lot of opportunities, and I just wanted to show my gratitude, and I thought the best way to do that is to come out here and run my best. I am honored. I know there are people, great people, that have gone before me to represent this great nation, and I am just honored to be part of that. Yeah.
These marathon trials attracted thousands of fans who lined the streets of Atlanta, and many came from all across the country. Keith Hesse of Michigan was one of the volunteers who supervised the course.
I've been a runner my whole life, a track coach and an official, and a senior Olympian myself. So after a 50-year running career, this is pretty cool.
Dylan Shipley and his mother Gloria flew into Atlanta from California early Saturday morning just to watch the race and flew home Saturday night. And Gretchen Nixon came from Texas.
Gosh, I just love the running community and how people get excited about that. But I'm also just really excited to see the athletes today, because I don't know if I'll ever make it to the actual Olympics, but this was a good one to be able to come and see. And to be up close for it, too. You know, like we're literally steps from the start line, so that's really neat, too.
Saturday's U.S. Olympic trials in Atlanta were run amid the concerns about COVID-19. Yesterday, only a couple of hundred elite athletes ran the Tokyo Marathon. Officials there canceled the race for the more than 35,000 everyday runners who were supposed to participate due to the coronavirus fears. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
Some breaking news this afternoon in the presidential race. Senator Amy Klobuchar will suspend her campaign for the Democratic nomination a day before Super Tuesday. Her campaign has confirmed the news in a statement to NPR's Juana Summers. Klobuchar will endorse former Vice President Joe Biden at a rally in Dallas tonight. We will keep an eye on that story. But meantime, in the run-up to tomorrow's Super Tuesday Democratic presidential primaries, voters in 14 states that are voting have heard a lot of this.
I'm Bernie Sanders, and I approve this message.
Persist PAC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
I'm Mike Bloomberg, and I approve this message.
Mainstream media outlets from broadcast and cable TV to radio networks require candidates and super PACs alike to disclose who's paying for an ad. But increasingly, campaign advertisements are migrating to platforms that do not require disclosure. Here and Now media analyst John Carroll is here with the details on that. Hi, John.
Hi, Jeremy.
So first, what are some of the places that don't have the accountability requirements?
It's new. We're seeing ads on podcasts. We're seeing ads on social news aggregator Reddit. We're seeing ads also on streaming services like Hulu and Roku.
And we're going to get to all those. How are Twitter and Facebook, first of all, dealing with political ads in this campaign? There have been a lot of them.
Yeah, Twitter took the easy way out. They're not accepting campaign ads.
Right.
Facebook has some limited targeting information. They have a link where you can see who paid for the ad. They've got a searchable ad library. But all of those things are things you have to seek out. None of them come to you automatically.
Axios has reported that the Trump campaign has redirected some of its Facebook ads to other online platforms. Trump spent millions on advertising on Facebook in 2016. Why is the campaign moving away from Facebook this time around?
They're looking to branch out and find new audiences. So they're going out to YouTube, Google, conservative podcasts. The first two disclose some information. Podcasts are totally uncharted territory.
And then there's Reddit. You mentioned the news aggregator and discussion forum that's been called the front page of the internet. How are candidates using Reddit?
Bernie Sanders is all over Reddit. He's the one who's been using it the most. And it's everything from traditional 30-second commercials to vintage footage of Bernie Sanders reading Dylan Thomas's poem, Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night. And also there's rapper and activist Killer Mike sermonizing at a Sanders rally.
Let's listen to a little bit of that.
So I want you to take a few seconds to look to your left and look to your right. Look to your neighbor and say, neighbor, the time is now. There are more of us. We're stronger. We will wait no longer.
How have Reddit users responded to ads like that?
Sanders has been so ubiquitous that one Reddit user about 5 months ago wrote, "How do I quit seeing Bernie Sanders ads? I blocked it multiple times, but it keeps coming up." It turns out that you have to pay not to see Sanders ads. But either way, Reddit does not disclose political ad spending.
Now, the Washington Post has reported that political ads are flooding Hulu, Roku, and other streamers. Are these the biggest unregulated platforms right now?
They are, and they are being bombarded with ads. There's virtually no transparency. So viewers are seeing all kinds of political ads, and in many cases, they have no idea who paid for them.
Now, nondisclosure is more often a problem for PACs and interest groups, more so than presidential candidates. We at least know something about how much money they're spending for ads on streaming services. What have you found?
Well, the Post reported that Elizabeth Warren, for instance, spent about $326,000 over a couple of months. Pete Buttigieg spent $100,000. The problem is a lot of campaigns buy these ads through third-party groups, and they don't have to report them on their FEC reports.
Is anybody proposing to expand the disclosure requirements to include these new digital platforms?
Well, they'd like to. The broadcast networks have to disclose information, but the transferring that to the web would be difficult because the federal government can regulate the broadcast networks because they own the public airways, but that's not true of the web. So you've got First Amendment issues there.
And some more breaking news, John. Pete Buttigieg is also going to endorse Joe Biden for the party presidential nomination. A lot happening. John Carroll, Here Now media analyst. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Bernie Sanders still holds a commanding lead in polls nationally ahead of Super Tuesday voting tomorrow. But with so many other candidates still in the race and those who just dropped out, as we heard, there are questions about whether Sanders will be able to secure enough delegates to win the nomination outright. And that's fueling talk of superdelegates backing a surprise candidate at the party convention this summer. Joining us now is superdelegate and Congressman Steve Cohen, a Democrat from Tennessee, one of the states holding its primary tomorrow. And Congressman Cohen, just to get an understanding of how this works, superdelegates are party leaders who, according to new rules, which were championed by Sanders' campaign back in 2016, are only allowed to vote if there's a contested nomination at the convention in July. Do you really think it will come down to that?
Well, I think it could. I mean, Bernie Sanders has a lot of support, and he's gotten, I think, the second most number of votes of anybody so far in this primary season. But it could come down to that. It depends, you know, what happens with Bloomberg, what happens with some other candidates, like as Tom Steyer and Pete Buttigieg decided to give up their campaigns. If others do that, it'll be a one-on-one race, and it could be the number of delegates they've got to this date that stop somebody. But if they all drop out, I think somebody might have a majority by the time it gets to the convention. If they'd all stayed in, I think it's less likely.
Yeah, you mentioned billionaire Tom Steyer and former Mayor Pete Buttigieg dropping out of the race. But would that drive enough Democrats and therefore delegates to Sanders specifically?
Well, I don't know if it does that or not. You know, Steyer is certainly playing the role of an outsider, but a billionaire outsider, which is a kind of a comfortable place to be an outsider. And Buttigieg was pretty much a moderate. He started more liberal, became more moderate. So I don't see where it drives more votes to Sanders. Joe Biden was a vice president who was in the area that the Buttigieg supporters might find as the right candidate. But I don't know. You know, you have to get this 15% minimum to get any votes at all. I'm not positive where those votes go if nobody else gets 15%, if they go to the top vote getter or if they're just uncommitted or what happens. But I think Biden needs to get to the 15% threshold, and this will help him do that and get more support. And those votes then will not go to Senator Sanders or be considered uncommitted.
You've expressed some support for nominating U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown at the convention if Sanders does not win the 1,991 delegates needed to win the nomination. Why would you do that?
Well, Sherrod Brown is, I think, one of the finest people we've got in Washington. He is an outstanding senator. He's had a great career from state legislator to, I believe he had a statewide office as well, and then to Congress and then to the Senate. He knows the Midwest. He knows working people. And he's a progressive. And his wife's
Sanders
a journalist.
Sanders is progressive,
so that's a good
too.
Thing. Well, and Sherrod's younger, too. And I think there are issues about both Vice President Biden and Senator Sanders' age. Sherrod's in his 60s. And I encouraged him to take the vice presidency if it was offered in 2016. And he said he didn't want to be vice president. And I think that was admirable. So a lot of people do it for advancement. He's not there for advancement. He's there to serve the people of Ohio and the Senate. And then this year, I've encouraged him to run for president. So I don't really foresee nominating Sherrod Brown because I think we'll end up with a choice of Vice President Biden or Senator Sanders. And my expressing that in that interview was more of the respect I have for Senator Sherrod Brown, who I think is, and a lot of people tell me that's who they like. He's that would be a phenomenal candidate.
You know, there's been lots of pontificating. There's been lots of talk about Michelle Obama being nominated for vice president as a unifying ticket. She said it's not something that she's interested in or would ever do. But I'm just wondering from you, would you say that's a sign really of desperation among Democrats?
Well, I don't think it's desperation, but I do think that my former state Senate colleague, Bill Owen, is who floated Michelle. I don't think Michelle would ever run. But I think there's a feeling among Democratic office holders that the number one priority is to beat Donald Trump. The number two priority is to keep the House and gain the Senate. I think there's a much better chance of doing that with Vice President Biden at the head of the ticket. It's just a question of whether or not you think that some Senator Sanders supporters would go to the position that some think they went to in 2016 and sit it out or vote for Jill Stein, or if you'd pick up more moderate housewife Republicans, women, who don't like Trump and his choice of language and attacks on people and women specifically, and if you'd pick them up, and then that would counter the loss on the Sanders side. But that's what a lot of my colleagues think, and I think that they're thinking correctly, that it would jeopardize a lot of the gains we made in 2018, and it might jeopardize the entire House majority. And I think we've got a shot at getting the Senate. We've got a real good shot in Arizona. We've got a good shot in Colorado. We've got a shot in North Carolina and in Kansas, where we could pick up seats, and that would make such a difference, because otherwise Mitch McConnell will stop whatever Senator Sanders or Vice President Biden or Amy Klobuchar tries to do as president.
So much to watch for. That's Representative Steve Cohen, Democrat from Tennessee. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Okay, now for something that has nothing to do with politics or the coronavirus. For the first time, cheetah cubs have been born by in vitro fertilization to a surrogate mother. The pair, a male and a female, were born February 19th at the Columbus Zoo in Ohio, and researchers see this as a promising step forward for the future of cheetahs. Joining us now is Dr. Adrian Crozier, a cheetah biologist at the Smithsonian's Conservation Biology Institute in Front Royal, Virginia. She was one of the scientists who performed this procedure. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you.
So you've actually held these cubs. What are they like?
They are pretty feisty, which is great. That's what you want when you have new cheetah cubs. They're supposed to be feisty and strong. Last I saw them a few days ago, the male cub's eyes were already open, and they're just great little cubs, and it was an amazing experience to be able to hold them.
And how big of a deal is this?
It's a very big deal. Scientifically, it is a huge breakthrough for us. We have been working on in vitro fertilization and embryo development in cheetahs for over 15 years. And this is a huge accomplishment for us, for the Smithsonian, and for cheetahs across the globe, really.
How did you do it? How difficult was the procedure?
Logistically, it is a bit of a challenging procedure. So there's carefully timed hormone injections that the female cheetahs need to receive before we do either the oocyte aspiration from the donor female or the transfer of the embryo into the recipient. And we actually collected the sperm from the male cheetah about a year ago at the Fossil Rim Wildlife Center in Texas, cryopreserved or froze that sperm sample, and have had it here in our bank at the Smithsonian for the last year. And so the male and female actually have never met each other. The biological parents never met each other.
Hmm. And the reason that you have to do this, by the way, is because it's difficult to get them to actually just mate naturally?
Cheetahs can be very challenging to get them to breed naturally. There's a lot of challenging behaviors. But another thing that really is a challenge for the cheetah managers is moving animals around the country. It can be extremely expensive and time-consuming for staff. It is somewhat stressful on the cats. And so this enables us to collect gametes from animals and move those gametes around in the form of sperm or oocytes without having to actually move the animals.
Dr. Crozier, give us a sense of why this is needed for cheetahs. How endangered of a species are they?
They are listed as vulnerable, and the numbers are less than 7,500 of these animals left in the wild. They're losing their habitat. They're losing their natural prey base. And what we have in our population in North America and also in other managed populations in human care around the world is a bit of an insurance population. And we're trying to do our best to maintain the health, the genetic health, as well as the population health of the animals in our care so that someday we can potentially take either some of these animals back into Africa or potentially take some of their genes in the form of eggs or embryos.
Hmm. Do you think that the cubs that were just born will ever be released into the wild?
It's a bit too early to forecast that, but we have been having some conversations with folks in South Africa recently, and I would love someday to be able to take some of the animals that were born here in North America and take them back to Africa and rewild them through that program or through another program to get them back into that African habitat.
Meanwhile, how soon do you think the public will be able to see them here in this country?
I'm not sure when the Columbus Zoo is going to have these cubs on display. Give them a few months to get a little bit older and a little bit stronger, but definitely stay tuned. I'm sure Columbus will be keeping everyone up to date on their growth and development and make sure the public knows when they're going to be able to see them.
When they're this small, do they feel just like another cat?
Similar, yeah. They're actually quite soft. Their fur is quite soft when they're this young. As they get older, their fur isn't quite as soft as it looks like it is.
Huh. Interesting. But you've gone over and pet a large cheetah. Is that scary?
Well, we do have opportunities when they're being examined by our veterinary staff. So we have been able to feel their fur, and it looks like it's quite soft. But when you actually get your hands on them, it's not as soft.
Now, cheetahs are known for being quite fast, right? They can go 0 to 60 in 3 seconds.
Yes.
So do you see any evidence of that at this young age, or are they quick as they're moving around?
Well, not yet. These guys are too small to move around quickly. You know, crawling is next, and by 3 or 4 weeks, they're going to be motoring around as pretty quick as their little legs will take them. But it's really, you know, before they're a few months old, before they can run quickly.
That is Dr. Adrienne Crozier, who's a cheetah biologist at the Smithsonian's Conservation Biology Institute. Doctor, thank you, and good luck with the new cubs.
Thank you so much.
And Tanya, they are really cute. They're at hereandnow.org. You can see them. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.